patient advocates for prevention, the future of healthcare reform, a look at implantable devices powered by the person's own body. Plus, we're going to take a look at the EMS medication adenosine. If that's what you're looking for, you will find it right here on the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. I'd like to welcome all of you to the program this week. A great show coming up for you in just a sec, including a couple of interesting news items looking at how we can become more actively involved in prevention measures by working alongside patients we have treated in the past. We'll look at that, plus some other things, and a review of the medication adenosine coming up later on in this episode of the MedicCast. Before we get to that, I do want to remind you to follow up on all of the information you'll find in every episode over at the MedicCast website. That's at medicast.com/blog. When you get over there, you'll find links to the show notes right there at the top of the page. Click that link and then you'll find the most recent episode, and you can scroll down and find all of the previous episodes. Use that link to follow up on the information, the links to the news items, the additional resource links for each week's tip of the week, all of that available for you over there at the MedicCast website. And I urge you to follow up on that there. If you want to get back in touch with me, I welcome your email. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I love to hear from you, and I respond back to every email that comes in. So keep those emails coming with your questions, your comments, your suggestions, and anything else you'd like to share with me. I love getting news links from people. It's hard for me to judge what you want to hear about in an episode, so when you send me a news item to take a look at for a future episode, it's a great opportunity for me to give back to you something you're interested in. So keep those communications coming and continue to be an active part of the MedicCast community. There'll be some more contact information coming up later on in this episode, but we should probably think about heading into this week's news items coming right up. Kicking off this week's news is a look at prevention of injury. You know, one of the things we're supposed to be actively involved with as healthcare professionals is prevention of injury. You know, so many things we run into in the field is related to something that could be prevented. It might be someone not wearing a helmet when riding a bicycle or riding on a skateboard, as in this article, or it could be something like drunk driving prevention information on preventing childhood illnesses. All of those are important things we should be involved with. But how do you get started in prevention in your communities? Well, there are a lot of resources out there, but one of the things that I found in this one article coming out of Oregon is a patient becoming an advocate for prevention. This was a situation where a young skateboarder was involved in a traumatic brain injury that had him in a coma, and actually they were expecting him not to recover at all. However, he defied those odds and came back from the severe brain injury and is actually attending college and has become an advocate for helmet use while playing and riding with skateboards. There's a lot of things out there. I know you see youths riding on skateboards or riding bicycles without helmets. The numbers on helmet use in those activities is abysmally low. And it's something that we can become actively involved with in our community through education, through information, and through talking to students one-on-one, getting peers of theirs to talk to them. And this is one of those situations where someone who has been an active member of these activities can come back and say, look, you know, I almost died because of this. Wear a helmet. You can still have just as much fun. I think this is important. And being an advocate for prevention in your community will continue to do what we need to do to lower those preventable calls that we don't have to go on. We can go on ambulance calls for heart disease, for cardiac arrest, for motor vehicle accidents. And yes, all of those things have some prevention ideas associated with them, but it does mean that we can take some of the strain off of our systems by being involved with prevention in our communities. And it might be doing safety fairs at schools. It might be taking teens on tours of morgues or accident victims, publicizing information, enlisting the families and the people involved in these injuries to come back and talk actively in the community about prevention, wearing seatbelts, things like that. So I would urge you to check out this article. It's quite extensive, talks about the extreme injuries this individual suffered, and goes on to talk about them being a strong advocate now for helmet use in skateboarding and other extreme activities. And I think this is something that we can become more involved with in our own communities. Well, the inauguration of President Obama is coming up for his second term later on this month. And along with that is going to be a lot of discussion about moving forward with the Affordable Care Act, bringing in the health care reforms that were initiated in his first term. Whether you agree with those things or not, they're going to happen. So how are they going to affect us in EMS? How are they going to affect healthcare systems in many locations? One of the things that's going to happen is the states are going to have to provide some form of safety net, expanding some of their Medicaid systems and providing other resources for people that cannot currently afford insurance and would be exempted from having to buy insurance and be provided some form of state-assisted insurance under the new plan. When that happens, what are we going to do? Where are these people going to find the primary care resources they need? And in some places, they may not be able to find primary care resources and may end up using the EMS system. Now, overall, I think this actually will take some of the strain off of our systems. I'm hoping that many of these people will find primary care resources, physicians, nurse practitioners. We may be able to redirect them to urgent care centers rather than to emergency departments where the costs are much lower and they will be treated and released much faster. However, it is something to keep in mind that those that cannot find primary care resources will continue to use the emergency department. And one of the things we should be actively involved with in our community is being an advocate for finding these patients a primary care physician or nurse practitioner that can help them and stave off an emergency department visit or a call to 911. So we need to start engaging in our communities to find ways to provide these people things like transportation to a primary care physician. You know, if they don't have a vehicle and there isn't public transportation because you're in a rural area, how do these people get to a primary care doctor? They can't. So they wait until the very last minute, until it's severe enough that they think it's an emergency, and then they have no recourse but to call 911 and get transportation using an ambulance. That's not an appropriate use of the system, but these people are feeling like there is an emergent situation going on, and we treat the patient and treat them compassionately. And then if there's a problem with how they access the system, let's see if we can find a way to fix it rather than penalizing them or treating them inappropriately when we care for them. And I think that that's something that is incumbent upon us in EMS as this moves forward, is finding a way to provide these people some resources in the community that will provide them an opportunity to not have to access the emergency department and the EMS system to achieve what could be managed more easily by primary care resource. We'll continue to follow up on this as the program continues to roll out through 2013 and into 2014, and the Affordable Care Act continues to enact its various portions of the law. We talk a lot here about implantable devices, about cool med gadgets, and one of the things that came up recently on my radar was a look at an implantable device that can be actually powered by one of the body's own power systems. You know, we have to think about it. Our body runs on electricity, so somewhere in our system there is something generating that electricity. It might be muscle tissue generating an electrical charge. In the ear, there is actually an electromechanical device that has to take sound waves, a mechanical input, and turn it into an electrical input that can be received by the brain. And that happens in the ear, and there is a tiny little battery in there, a cellular electrical current device that generates electricity and helps to translate that mechanical sound of audio. If you're listening to this show or watching this show and hearing my voice, that mechanical energy hits your eardrum, is transferred into electrical energy using this tiny battery source. So if you could hook a small chip up to that would be able to send signals from an implanted device, then you wouldn't have to have a battery implanted in a person, and they could have this device implanted for a long-term basis. Think of all the things we have that have batteries implanted in the body's implanted devices. If there was a way to harness the body's own energy resources, wouldn't it be cool to have a smaller cardioverter defibrillator implanted in someone's chest that it's so tiny we can't even tell it's there anymore? Now, maybe that's not a good thing, but the reason it's so bulky and the size of a pack of cards the way it is that it has a battery in there that has to last for, I don't know, 8 to 10 years. Well, what would happen if we could find a way to harness the body's own electrical output and find a way to harness that electricity to power implanted devices like that? It's a pretty cool opportunity and idea, and it's been proven in concept with some of their animal research, and they're starting to look at ways to access this technology and use it for human use. That's pretty exciting, and you can find the link in the article here that looks at directly how that's going to be applied. I think it's pretty cool, and I will continue to bring you interesting medical gadgets like this in the future. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and we're continuing our series on cardiology and medications associated with that by looking at the drug adenosine. We don't often use this medication, but we will be looking at some of its indications, contraindications, side effects, and uses and doses coming up here in this episode of the MedicCast. And that tip segment on adenosine is coming right up. So let's go ahead and get into this EMS med review of adenosine. We're going to look at the mechanism and class of the medication, as well as the indications, contraindications, side effects, and precautions to keep track of and be aware of. We'll look at some drug interactions and also common dosing, and we'll talk a little bit about how this medication needs to be administered to be most effective. And we'll talk about all of that coming right up. First off, mechanism. This is an antiarrhythmic medication. It is used to break an arrhythmia in a patient. In this case, it's used to break supraventricular tachycardias. It's a naturally occurring nucleoside. If you remember your cellular biology, adenosine triphosphate is the primary energy source at the end of the cellular metabolism, breaking down that ATP and using that ATP for energy. And when it burns sugar and the presence of oxygen, it creates ATP. So remember that cellular biology. That's a very simplified version of it, but it's essentially what goes on. So it's naturally occurring in the body. It also, though, when administered adenosine in this form, will actually break heart arrhythmias. And it does that by slowing conduction through the AV node. And so it's something to keep in mind. Think about where the AV node lies in the heart. Look at your anatomy. We have the rhythms usually starting in the sinus node. It comes down through the atria and then into the AV node, the atrioventricular node, and then out into the ventricles. So it's in the middle of the heart. Anything below the AV node, this medication is not going to have any effect on. So any kind of ventricular rhythm is not going to have any effect. It also has some peripheral vasodilation effects, and that can be very dramatic and cause profound hypotension in a patient. So that's a side effect we'll talk a little bit about later on. It has a very rapid onset. Because this drug is readily used by the body for energy in its cellular form, imagine how quickly the cells grab on to free-floating ATP in the bloodstream. ATP in the bloodstream gets used up very quickly. So the adenosine gets used up and attached. So we need to administer this drug in a rapid flush, followed by a flush of saline or lactated ringers, whatever your IV fluid is, and administered with that flush pushing it far up into the vein. We want to administer this in an IV site that is close to the heart. So we want to go for that AC line rather than something down in the hand. Again, that it doesn't seem like much, but you're talking about maybe a foot and a half of space, doubling the distance to the heart in something that only lasts for 10 to 20 seconds. This is something that we need to be aware of. So remember that. The indications are slow, narrow complex tachycardias. We say narrow complex, but we're talking about supraventricular tachycardias. Tachycardias originating north of the AV node in the atria somewhere, either in the sinus, supraventricular tachycardia related to a really fast sinus rhythm. And you really wouldn't see it sinus tachycardia that would be that severe, but something north of the AV node. It's going to produce rates above, like, let's say 180 beats or 220 beats per minute. You get up into that upper range there and you start having a tachycardia that is beating so fast that there's no time for preload to happen. And so the effectiveness of the heart pump becomes much less. It's only effective on those SVTs. It will include Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. That's that reentry pathway arrhythmia, and that is occurring in the atria, and so it is also included as Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. It has no effect on other arrhythmias. Contraindications include second or third degree heart block. Again, think about second or third degree heart block for a minute. Second or third degree heart block is in the AV node, and it is a mostly complete or completely complete heart block. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense to you, but second and third degree heart blocks mean that not all of the beats or none of the beats from the atria are getting to the ventricles at all. So if you do anything to slow down the conduction through those pathways, it's not going to have any effect. So start looking elsewhere for where your tachycardia is coming from. It may be you're looking at a ventricular tachycardia that's masking itself with a narrow signature in your ECG, and start checking where your leads are placed. Start looking in other leads for identification of whether you have a ventricular tachycardia that's presenting as a narrow tachycardia in lead 2. You should be looking in other leads for things. You should be doing 12 leads on these patients so you can identify exactly what's going on. Hypersensitivity is one of those things you need to keep track of in any medication. Also, a history of moderate to severe asthma or active bronchospasm going on. And the reason for this is that additional side effect of this medication is that it can cause bronchospasm or worsen existing bronchospasm. So we want to be aware of patients with a history of moderate to severe asthma. Ask that question. This is new information that's been reported in the last year or two. So if you've been memorizing adenosine for the last 15 years, guess what? This is something that's popped up on the radar relatively recently. So you should be aware of that. Also, anyone with a polymorphic, irregular, wide complex tachycardia, guess what? It ain't going to work anyway, so don't give a drug frivolously. Maybe this would be a medication you'd administer later when you tried other things for polymorphic, irregular, wide complex tachycardia after consulting with medical control. Maybe they say, yeah, go ahead and try adenosine, but this is not something that you're going to try on your own, and certainly not as a treatment of choice. Side effects include flushing, dyspnea and chest pressure, nausea and dizziness, headache, hypotension, as we talked about, and up to 40 seconds of asystole. That's right. You are going to cause this patient to basically flatline. You're going to stop conduction of the signal from the atria of their heart to the ventricles in their heart. And when you do that, they cease to have any heart rhythm. That's going to happen for up to 40 seconds. Believe me, it will be the longest 40 seconds of your life. If you've never given this medication before, you want to prepare the patient that they're going to feel uncomfortable. Guess what? They're going to notice pretty quickly that the heart has stopped beating. They're not going to be sure what exactly is going on, and you don't want to explain it to them, but they're going to notice that they're not pumping blood. Their body's not going to start sending them some panic signals. So you want to be preparing them, saying, you're going to be a little uncomfortable when I administer this medication. Just bear with me. You're going to be feeling some flushing, some chest pressure. That's all normal, and I'm going to be right here with you. And then you're going to administer the medication. You're going to go ahead and wait for those long, interminable seconds for that heart rhythm to start back up again. And you may or may not convert the SVT to a normal sinus rhythm with the administration of this drug. It'll either come back up as a sinus rhythm, or it'll come back up as a as the previous rhythm, the SVT, in rare occurrences, and I've never met anybody this happened to, but it doesn't mean it can't. When you convert somebody to asystole, they could potentially stay in asystole. And if they do, you want to get the pads out immediately and prepare to pace these patients. So this is just something to keep in the back of your mind. You might want to unzipper the pads and have them just kind of available. And you're already going to have this patient's chest exposed. You've done a 12 lead on them already. So if you need to, you can get the pads on very quickly. But it is a possibility that the asystole will continue and they will not reconvert. So it's something to keep in mind. Drug interactions. This medication is antagonized by theophylline. It's also effects can be enhanced by some medications, including digitalis, carbamazepine, and others. Calcium channel blockers and benzodiazepines will enhance the effects of this medication. Now, here we go. The common ACLS dosing for this medication. All you have to remember is 6, 12, and 12, folks. 6 milligrams rapid IV push, followed by a rapid saline or lactated Ringer's flush, followed by, and if no effect in 2 minutes, you can follow it with a 12 milligram rapid IV push, and you may repeat that dose. So 6, 12, and 12 are your adult doses for this medication. Pediatric doses, 0.1 milligrams per kilogram rapid IV push to the max adult dose for each round. So max to 6 for the first dose, and then max to 12 milligrams in the subsequent doses. And my protocols say only give this twice and then consult. So that may be something that you might have different, but for pediatric patients, we only administer the 6 and the 12. But for adults, it's 6, 12, and 12. I have heard that some recent literature is pointing to the fact that after 6, 12, and 12, some physicians are seeing some success with going to 18. That is not something that is recommended by protocol. It is not something that is in ACLS. I mention it to you because I've read some things in the literature that say that this may be something that comes up, and you may, after consulting with someone and not having the rhythm break, your ER physician may instruct you to administer 18. So just be aware that that is a possibility if the rhythm doesn't break with 12. There are some physicians out there writing in the literature that have seen some success with 18 on a fourth dose. Again, that is not the recommended dosing, and it is not something that you're ever going to be tested on. But it is something I want you to be aware of. You might get that in a medical consult coming back from the hospital when you call in, and they're going to say, go ahead and try this. So it's something that I just wanted you to give you a heads up. There's a lot of additional resources in the show notes for this episode. I always include links to the Maryland EMS protocols, which is where I draw my protocols from. However, you can also look at places like jointemsprotocols.com, and I've pulled some information from Wikipedia on adenosine. Generally, on a lot of these common medications, Wikipedia is not a bad resource. They're well-documented and well-referenced. But again, I always use some caution when I recommend Wikipedia links, but in this case, it seems to be pretty solid, and I include that in additional resources. You can find more resources like this over at the MedicCast episode site at MedicCast.tv or in the show notes for this episode. And you can find all of that over at MedicCast.com/blog. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and urge you to follow up on all of the information available for you over at the MedicCast website. You'll find that at mediccast.com/blog. When you get over there, there's a link for show notes right at the top of the page. When you click that link, you can find all of the episodes going all the way back to episode one if you want to scroll down and go back far enough. There's information there on all the news items discussed in each episode, as well as all of the information and additional resources on each week's tip of the week. And it's your job to follow up on those additional resources. Look at your own protocols and make sure you understand how things I talk about here on the show apply or don't apply to your own scope of practice. So please make sure you follow up on that information. If you want to get back in touch with me, I love to hear from you. Send emails in to me here, podmedic@mac.com. I want to hear from you, and I do respond back to every email that comes in, and I share some of those emails here on the show. So keep those emails coming with your comments, your suggestions, corrections, or information you'd like to share with the other members of the MedicCast community. If you want to follow up with me on social media sites, you can usually find me under the handle PodMedic. So twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic, things like that. And of course, don't be afraid to head on over to the MedicCast fan page and become a fan of the MedicCast on Facebook. That's at facebook.com/MedicCast. And when you get there, you'll actually find a like button at the top of the page, click that like button, and then there are additional articles, resources, videos, and other things I post over there that may not come out here on the weekly show, but you'll be able to find those resources over there on the MedicCast page. And one of the things you can do over on Facebook is comment, click the like button on an article, and if you're already a fan, that's a great way to share and expand the reach of the MedicCast community to other people you know. So don't be afraid to like something, don't be afraid to comment on something, and start a dialogue with some of the other members of the MedicCast community about a given article. I try to answer back whenever someone comments, and it's important for us to continue that discussion and maybe find a future interesting tip or article segment for a future MedicCast episode. I look forward to hearing from you over there. That's it. We'll go ahead and close out this episode of the MedicCast. I will remind you, I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. I'll be back here every week on Monday with another MedicCast episode. And in the meantime, I want you to remember, scene safety and BSI.